thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 50 for the 14th of January, 2010. The Crystal Ball Returns. It's time for the magical Golden Anniversary Edition of the Digital Campus podcast from the Center for History and New Media here at George Mason University in chilly Fairfax, Virginia. Welcome back to our audience and welcome back to our Golden regulars, Tom Scheinfeld and Mills Kelly. Hey, Tom and Mills.
Hey.
Well, we did that in two-part harmony.
You guys have been practicing over holiday. We did have a holiday break, so sorry. We were doing so good on keeping to our bi-weekly schedule, but we're delighted to be back after a holiday and various conferences and the sparsely attended AHA. Actually, I haven't gotten a number for the American Historical Association convention in much less chilly San Diego, but maybe we'll have a chance to talk about that on a future podcast, but we have the present podcast in which we're excited to talk about, as we do every year, the biggest stories of the past year and our predictions. Always on target, right, guys?
Never wrong.
Never wrong. It's money in the bank, really. Predictions for the coming year, and since it is a odometer-like turnover to the next decade, except for those sticklers who believe it begins in 2011. We're also going to go over our stories of the decade from the past decade and our giant predictions, which actually probably will be horribly wrong for the coming decade. And if we're still podcasting in 2020, we will certainly let you know. So let's dive right in and talk about the stories of 2009, just sticking to the prior year. And we're going to each go over one thing that we thought was the story of 2009. So there'll be three choices for each segment: the story of 2009, story of 2000 to 2010, our prediction for 2010, and our prediction for 2010 to 2020. So my story, I'll start right off, is from the past year. I think it's got to be the rise of ebook readers, really spurred by the Kindle, and then toward the end of the year, proliferating with the Nook and the Sony new models from Sony, which of course did have an e-reader. And then, of course, all of this, I think, really climaxing, I suppose, in a couple of weeks with the rumored release of this Apple tablet, which I suspect, again, was sort of spurred by the Kindle. If the Kindle wasn't around, we'd probably be waiting a year or two or more for Steve Jobs to perfect whatever this tablet was. So, Tom Mills, what are your thoughts? We did obsess looking back here at our show notes from 2009 with the e-reader. I think there was almost not a single podcast that we didn't mention it. Is this an important story and an ongoing story that our listeners should care about?
I think so. I mean, go ahead,
Tom.
Are you guys going to be in harmony the entire time?
We might.
Yeah.
We might.
Okay,
if we get one more, it could be a barbershop quartet here on the podcast.
Okay, I'll go first on this one. You go first on the next one, Tom.
All right. Okay. Go right ahead, Mills.
I do think it's a really important story. I mean, I think there's still a lot of work to be done, as evidenced by the fact that a number of universities dumped using Kindles because of the lack of access for blind students. So, you know, if it's going to make a big difference in higher education, there are obviously some ebook readers in general. There are obviously some tweaks that are going to have to be made, if only to comply with things like disability access. But I do think, you know, it is going to make a difference eventually, if only because it's going to have an effect on the textbook market as more and more of these books become available in that kind of format. And I'll just say the other thing I noticed this year around the holidays was how many people I know who are not sort of tech geeks who got Kindles for some sort of holiday present, and now they're just obsessed with all the books they can get. And so the fact that people I know who aren't really into the technology in general are really into their ebook readers. One has a Sony reader. I think that is another sign that it's really starting to, the reach of these products is really starting to spread.
Yeah, I agree. And like we've been talking about the rise of the ebook reader for, a decade probably now. And it really does seem with the Kindle to have reached a critical mass. I mean, among the very first digital library and digital humanities projects were kind of ebook projects, Gutenberg E and others, that sort of were interesting projects, but didn't really have a platform to make them convenient and easy to use and accessible. And I think, with the Kindle, we now see that. And I think we're going to continue in 2010 to just see a proliferation. And I think we just saw that if you look at the coverage of the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, there's a lot of new ebook products coming out. And I think the Kindle is going to have some competition, but I do think the Kindle set the standard and brought these things into the mainstream.
Yeah. I mean, I'd agree with all this. I think, Mills, your point about the mainstream piece of this, it was remarkable at the American Historical Association convention, which, had out of thousands of people, I think about 10 people on Twitter, had quite a few people with the Kindle. And a lot of these people, I mean, I was sort of noticing this as I walked around in the hotels, and actually talked to a couple people. These are people without iPhones or without Android phones. So this is the high-tech thing that they chose to buy. And I think for the academic market, it is kind of a neat thing. I think especially with the WhisperNet and the ability to get any book and to read the first chapter of any book. And then I think late in the year, the fact that there were these new readers that took any of the EPUB versions of books from Google, which now is Google Books has a million of these books that you can just download and stick on these devices. I think it really created something that academics could really latch on to, people in the museum and library world who are heavy book readers. I think it made a lot more sense than, Twitter on an iPhone. It was a new technology that was easily understood and easily adopted. Okay, well, I think we got to move on here. We're staying on a Marshall schedule. Sorry, Mills. Do you want to get in a quick final comment on that? Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think that one other thing about these e-readers is that people have an investment in the technology itself. They buy a thing, and so they're going to continue to use it, as opposed to some software app which isn't an actual tangible thing.
Yes, I completely agree. And I think, it doesn't feel like it's something with complex software on it. I mean, the fact of that e-ink screen, it just feels like a solid book. You're getting a book. Okay. Tom, let's move on to you. Your story of 2009 was, drumroll please.
My story of 2009 was not unrelated to Kindle. It was continued developments in the mobile sphere, and in particular, the rise of Android. I think Android started out the year on one device, the T-Mobile G1, and by the end of the year, it was on a bunch of devices on most of the major carriers, and Google had released or announced the release of its own Google phone running Android. The operating system had been through several revisions, and it's getting to the point where, and I think most experts agree, it is the challenger to the iPhone in the smartphone space. And I think in 2010, we're going to see just a continued proliferation of Android devices and some serious competition for Apple's iPhone. But more broadly, I think we're going to see, because there's going to be more devices on more networks, various price points with various feature sets. Some will have slide-out keyboards, some won't. Some will have large screens, some will have small screens. We're going to see continued heavy adoption of smartphones among kind of the general population, and I think that has important ramifications for all kinds of educational and cultural heritage applications, because only 1 in 10 of your students or 1 in 10 of your visitors has one of these things, it maybe doesn't make sense to put a lot of effort and money into developing programming for them. When you know, 1 and 2 or even 3/4 of your visitors or students have these devices in their pockets, then it starts to really make sense to start developing. So I think we're going to see with the proliferation and continued adoption, we're going to see more and more custom applications and websites for these smartphone devices.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just saw an ad recently for a Android phone that was $49. And I was thinking that for students in particular, you know, a lot of them do get phones for free. I mean, when they're getting their cell phone, they're looking for things that are inexpensive, even though, of course, the main cost of the phone comes in that monthly fee. But for a lot of those students, I think the $200 or $300 smartphone was out of reach. And, you know, even at the end of the year when the iPhone dropped, or the sort of slightly older version of the iPhone dropped to $99, you could see a very rapid adoption, at least on our campus. And I assume that will continue. Mills, we've been plugging away. Actually, I think mobile was our prediction for 2009.
I think it was. And as evidence of how Android's kind of changed the calculus on this, I would hold myself up, because you guys know probably that I'm one of the last holdouts with my crappy old phone. But so I have to do something in April when my contract with my provider runs out. And I've been all of a sudden waffling about whether I'm going to actually go for the iPhone or an Android phone. So I've been in the stores, I've been looking at them, and I just right now can't make up my mind, because both, you know, iPhone has many attractions, but the Android is really tempting also. So I think it is really – it's going to force all sorts of nice changes in the way that the cell phone systems work.
Can you expand on that a little bit more?
Well, I think that with the, you know, the open source aspect of Android, we're going to see, you know, people not being so locked into the Apple structures, and, you know, a lot more innovation coming from just sort of average users and people playing around with it. But then from an educational standpoint, along the lines of what you were saying, as more and more of our students have access to this, then it makes it possible for us to start expecting, you know, some students to use the GIS capabilities of their phones, for instance. And, you know, not a year ago we talked about, well, you know, you could do this with an iPhone. Now, with, I hadn't seen the $49 ad, but, you know, the pretty inexpensive phones make this possible. And so that really expands the possibilities for what faculty members can expect from their students.
Right, right. I mean, what is nice about the Android is that just the ease of getting the software on that. I mean, if you have to go through the Apple store, you know, it's just, there's a lot of friction for just a small developer in a university or museum or library. But, you know, with Android, you can have a little you know, barcode or something on the entrance to your museum or library or on your syllabus even, that you can just shoot and it will load up software needed for that class. And you can imagine all kinds of uses. So just much easier to operate on. Of course, you know, with that openness comes a little bit more in terms of headaches. And I do wonder about the different sizes of these screens and resolutions and so forth on Android, kind of hurting the ability of designers and software engineers to kind of get stuff on there that looks well, that looks good. But I guess we'll see. Okay, Mills, your story of 2009.
My story of 2009 is the Google settlement. You know, we certainly beat it to death on the podcast, but I do think that it really is a big deal, because it now, you know, the gate is now opened, and we know what, how wide the gate is, and we know, you know, we know what all the parameters are. And so now everybody can start moving forward, as opposed to contending so much about how we're going to move forward. And I think we'll finally see what Google's real plan is for the digitization project. You know, is this just, you know, is it their, the sort of stated goal of, you know, digitizing all the world's literature, or is it also something that's going to be a big profit center for them? And So I'm really looking forward to seeing the way that it plays out. I'm just glad that the settlement finally happened.
Yeah, I mean, this is clearly going to be an ongoing story because it actually hasn't been settled yet. And we can talk more about that in a second. But it does seem that, you know, Pamela Samuelson, who's a professor at Berkeley, has written a lot about Google Books. And, you know, I think her main point, she recently came out with a paper in which it said, effectively, when Google Books search settlement is copyright reform. That at its base, it is effectively putting in place new law in the copyright realm that we really kind of haven't seen in the academic world, or any other world, that it is de facto making new law. And in that way, it's extremely important that, obviously, I think part of our point here is that this isn't how law should be made, and that there should have been a congressional act to deal with things like out of print works that we can't find the owners of and that we'd like to put online. And what do you do in those cases? But she's made a pretty forceful and I think probably correct argument that this is a very substantial change to the way copyright works. That it's an opt-out situation. That there's a lot of these books that unless someone comes forward, they're sort of going to be there and they're going to be online, and it's going to change the landscape of books, forever. So clearly very important. Tom, what are your thoughts on this ongoing settlement saga?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're gonna, I think we're still in wait and see mode. I mean, it could end up being the big story of 2010 as well. I mean, it has really dragged on now. I remember first hearing about the settlement. I was at happened, I guess it's probably October 2008, and here we are in January 2010, still waiting. And I think the fact that it's been delayed so long shows just how important this really is. I mean, people are really, really interested and upset and concerned and everything else about this issue. And I think, it says a lot about a lot of different things: the importance of cultural heritage and access to it, the power of Google and how maybe Google's position in the marketplace and in the conventional wisdom and general consciousness is changing. That it was a kind of golden company through the last decade, and maybe in the next decade, it's going to be it's going to face some new skepticism by consumers. So, I mean, I think this is really, really something to continue watching, and I am positive we'll be talking about it over the course of the next year.
Yep, big story, and I have a feeling we'll be hearing more about it momentarily. Okay, let's move on to stories of the decade. I'm sure, like our audience, we're glad to move on from 2009, but just to look back at a tough full decade here from 2000, where the dot-coms were still flying high and everyone was getting used to the web, and including in museums, libraries, and the universities. Let's start with you, Tom. But what was your big story of the decade that really you felt sort of wasn't around in our consciousness in 2000, but really established itself by 2010?
I'm going to point to the rise of open source software. I think that in 2000, the you know we were in a world of Microsoft, where Internet Explorer had essentially crushed Netscape. Netscape was on the ropes or disappearing. I guess had disappeared by then. We were in a world of where Microsoft's web services frameworks, .NET and ASP and others were looking like those were going to be the dominant ones for the next decade. And I think we find ourselves now in a situation where where the probably the most popular platform for web applications is certainly in our world of academia, I think probably is the LAMP platform, the Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP platform. I think Linux has certainly on the server side has taken off. Apache is the most widely used web server in the world, and then even on the consumer end user end of things, we see things like Firefox, which actually initially was codenamed Phoenix, really, and is the descendant of Netscape, rising from the dead and becoming in many ways the what looks like the browser of the future. I just saw a report that Firefox 3.5 is the single most widely used web browser version on the web. I mean, if you take Internet Explorer 6, 7, and 8 together, it's bigger than the Firefox usage. But if you just take Firefox 3.5 and put it up against Internet Explorer 6, Internet Explorer 7, or Internet Explorer 8, Firefox 3.5 is the world's most popular web browser. That's really pretty amazing. I don't think any of us would have said that in 2000 when Microsoft was in danger of being broken up for being a monopoly. I don't think any of us would have said that the descendant of Netscape would be looking like a serious challenger, let alone a possible winner in the browser right. wars. So
it really so is pretty incredible, isn't it?
This rise. So I think the rise of open source is what I would point to, and I think we can see it in all areas of the communities we cover. In the library world, I think we see open source ILSs. Things like Koha and Evergreen. I think in the museum world, we see things like Collection Space and our own Omeka. In the university world, I think we see things like in course management, Moodle and Sakai, and in research management in our own Zotero. So, I think this is really big, and I don't think we would have said that in 2000.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely have to agree. I mean, I think that the knock against open source has always been that there's not been, or for most of the 2000s, the aughts, that there wasn't a desktop operating system. But meanwhile, behind the scenes, of course, even as early as 2000, much of the web was being run on Linux, Apache, MySQL, and some flavor of a P scripting language, PHP or Perl, all of which were open source. And that just intensified over the decade. And then Firefox, really, which for most people really did become the desktop. And it's pretty incredible when you think that someone has to take action to actually put Firefox on their computer, in most cases, right? I mean, if you are getting, not for 90% of the people in the world who get a Windows desktop machine or a Windows laptop, I mean, they have to go to Firefox.com or getfirefox.com and download this thing. And the fact that we're, at 25%, that on a lot of campuses already by the end of 2009, a lot of campuses, particularly in Europe, were over 50% Firefox or well over 50% Firefox. And, I think that this is a really critical movement that will just continue.
Well, and I think that the fact that, Chrome, Google Chrome has not managed to push Firefox aside is another piece of really important evidence for the strength of this. Because I was worried when, Chrome came out, this is going to be the next big thing from Google. And I was a pretty devoted Firefox user, but should I now switch? And I'm still very happy with Firefox.
Right, right. Well, I mean, and there again, it'll be interesting to see if Chrome does take off, whether it steals market share from Firefox or IE, but certainly it seems like IE has been limping along and has lost many percentage points. I mean, it just continues to decline both in the aggregate and then as Tom notes, in particular versions, which if you're a web designer is rather infuriating, very tough to handle. Okay. Open source, Tom Scheinfeld, story of the decade. Mills, what do you see as really the story from the past 10 years that we should have paid attention to?
Well, for me, it's a connected story, and that is what you might call open classrooms. And that is that one of the things is I've watched education closely over the last decade. I've seen is a big change, and that is the openness of teaching and learning in higher education that's occurred as a result of these various technologies, whether it's the use of podcasting and broadcasting lectures and on iTunes U or some other platform, the Open Courseware Project at MIT, people writing. There was a big project in the early part of the decade based at the University of Kansas called the Course Portfolio Project, where people were writing up these extensive course portfolios about their teaching and their students' learning. And this has now just kind of become a standard activity on a lot of campuses around the country, that faculty members would write these things as evidence of what is happening in their classroom. And if you think back to the 90s and every decade before that, the classroom was really a closed, private space where the faculty member and the students engaged in their teaching and learning activities. And the only people who got to watch that were the the people in the, you know, the registered students, the faculty member, and perhaps the occasional peer reviewer coming in to watch the faculty member. But otherwise, it was a really closed environment. And now, classrooms are really, lots and lots of classrooms are really wide open. I mean, the number of lectures broadcast on YouTube is just phenomenal. And actually, I saw an ad in the Chronicle yesterday for some cultural anthropologist whose name didn't stick with me, but he was listed in, he was going to be at some program at the University of North Carolina. He's a cultural anthropologist and YouTube celebrity. So I guess that's right. my next career ambition is YouTube celebrity. But just the fact that somebody could be described in this way, you know, an academic could be described right. in this way.
It would be like saying, you know, Wikipedia author and professor of history.
But I think this is an incredibly positive development for higher education because it not only does it introduce some level of accountability in what happens in the classroom, but also it makes for this just really rich sharing of information about teaching and learning. So that if I'm, you know, if I want to try some new teaching method, I could scan around now and find somebody who's already doing it, and I could watch them. Or I could listen to them. And, you know, it's amazing to me. I just put up some podcasts of some of my lectures from a course I taught a couple of years ago. And I get a couple of emails a month from just people out there who have listened to one or the other lectures and say, oh, I really like that lecture you gave about the Slovak National Uprising. And I can't imagine that somebody was actually listening to that. And so it does create this environment of openness about teaching and learning that was completely non-existent in higher education until the past decade.
Yeah, great. It's a really great story. I mean, it's really hard to imagine. You know, I had the same experience when I created this little syllabus finder tool, where a lot of professors and just the general public sort of thanked me for making visible just the mechanisms of learning and the content that, you know, it's just been holed up in these places. And, you know, the only thing that the general public and that professors sort of read and see of each other is sort of in these official publications. And I think that this mass of, you know, I guess what you'd call, I hate to call them secondary materials, but I've sort of called them that in my own writing, but these other facets of professorial work and work in other cultural heritage and learning spheres is suddenly, you know, widely available, searchable, etc. And I think we really do need to give credit to Apple here a little bit for highlighting iTunes U so much in their software, you know, on their iPods, the fact that it's got its own line in the iPod right next to podcasts. It really did take off, and you see incredible numbers for some of these lectures. But even on the long tail, it's incredible that that people, you know, are learning in a more broad sense. Well, for my story of the decade, I apologize. I know we're obsessing about this company, but I really feel like I need to go with Google. But Google as a kind of symptom or manifestation or the most successful version of modern search technology. You know, I think the fact of this deceptively simple search box, the fact that it was just this little box on a page that somehow magically fished out of the giant sea of web documents precisely what you were looking for, I think really revolutionized the way we're thinking about research, you know, the way we kind of leave part of our brain on the web because we know we can kind of Google it if need be. And then also Google as the fact that it is the company taking all the kind of modern web technologies and bringing them to the masses. So, I mean, the fact of Gmail and Google Docs and all these things, I mean, I think it is a symptom of a lot of what we've discussed on the podcast of the importance of cloud computing and web scale computing, I think is really the key here, that the transference of power away from the desktop and into the web, that they really understood the web and how it worked and that they understood it for search and that they're now starting to understand this in other realms, including mobile for me. And I really had an eye-opening experience this last semester where, you know, it was the fall of 2009. And so I have, you know, 18-year-old student who came up to me who was born in the 90s, you know, and came of age with Google, right? I had never not known Google. So I had my first student who sort of didn't realize that there was a universe before Google. And I just, you know, I know that there's a lot of debate about digital natives and whether they exist and these sorts of things. But this really struck me that there is now a generation that's coming up that has never known that there was a way of kind of doing research before Google. It really struck me as something important from the last decade. I've silenced you both.
Yeah. Okay. I was trying. You know what it was? I was trying to wrap my mind around a student who had never known a world without Google. And
it's pretty shocking. I mean, you know, they try to think. You know, I prodded at this person. You know, like anthropologists did in Fiji in the 1780s. You know, like, who are the? You know, what are you like? And how do you go about the world, you know? But I think we're going to see more of this. That I think that in particular, I do not know that there are young people, and I certainly have them in my classes where, you know, who are kind of clueless about the online world. But everybody knows about Google, and it is the first stop. It's first stop, and it's often for people one-stop shopping. And I think also in just the museum and library world, I think the existence of Google made a lot of people there rethink how they were providing access to their resources. And I think that's very important. You could certainly see it in the changes to websites and online, you know, catalogs, library catalogs and museum collections. So, okay, I've clearly deadened conversation. So why don't we move on from stories of the decade to our predictions first for 2010. Well, maybe I should continue right here since I'm obsessing about Google. And since I was sort of positive about Google in my story of the decade, my prediction for 2010, I really got this from a European conference I went to in December in Florence, which I was lucky to go to in Florence. And I felt there was a big audience of about 300, mostly Europeans or a couple dozen Americans there, but it was mostly representatives of cultural heritage organizations and European funding agencies in Europe. And I really got the sense, talking to people over coffee and wine and food, that there is really this surging backlash to Google's digitization efforts. And my prediction for 2010 is that there will be, particularly if the settlement goes through as is, which I predict it will for the most part, I think there's going to be a serious revolt on this front. I think we've already seen it, this hinted at in what's gone on in France, where Sarkozy pledged $1 billion to digitize French materials, although just this past week he sort of backtracked and said, well, maybe we'll have Google do that for free instead. But also the Dutch library, the Dutch Royal Library, is, you know, pledged to digitize all Dutch books and newspapers and magazines dating back to 1470. So I think there's this real feeling that starting in Europe, but I think it's going to spread to other places, that perhaps some of these alliances with Google and what Google's doing is the wrong way to go. And, you know, I was on this panel on Is Google Good for History out in San Diego at the American Historical Association meeting. And, I realized as I was talking that what struck me as wrong is that what Google did in the 2000s, in the last decade, is it overlaid its services on top of the existing web, that it was really good at taking decentralized materials and making it accessible and findable. And that what's odd about Google Books is here for once, Google is trying to kind of, it feels to a lot of people like they're trying to monopolize and centralize the material as well as providing search. So they've gone from being one kind of company to being something very different in Google Books. And I think that feeling, you know, why didn't Google just sort of centralize the search of books that were being digitized by others and being scattered around the web? That feeling is going to provoke a backlash in 2010.
You know, I tend to agree that, and I think it's going to go beyond 2010, that there is going to be kind of a backlash against Google. And I think in many ways, it's the sort of the normal cycle that it seems like these technology companies go through, where you know, they start out providing a product that or a service that wasn't available previously, and they do it in a way that is much more accessible than what came before it. I think you could look at Microsoft and their DOS operating system for personal computers as providing computing access in a way that was vastly expanded from what IBM previously had provided. IBM was selling large computers to large institutions, and Microsoft made it possible for smaller players to have these machines. I think Google did it in the same way. They kind of opened up the search technology with the web access to this new information resource in a way that wasn't possible beforehand. But they've kind of grown large, and they're starting to become protective of their markets. And I think Google Books is definitely an instance of that. And I think we're going to start to see maybe more instances of that. They've been open throughout much of the past decade, almost unprecedentedly open in their business dealings and in this kind of economy of free that they've created and benefited from. And I wonder if they're, now that they are the big player, whether that's going to continue. And I wonder whether, that is going to cause some backlash against them. So I tend to totally agree with you, Dan, on that one.
Yeah, but I think in the United States, there's going to be there may be a lot of verbal backlash, but I don't think there's going to be a lot of practical backlash because there's simply no money for it. In higher education, for sure, across North America, there's no money. And then last time I noticed, the U.S. government had a pretty big deficit, and so there's who's going to start a new digitization effort to challenge what Google's doing, to provide an alternative to what Google's doing? And so I don't think we're going to see a lot of practical challenge. I think we're just going to see a lot of talking about it.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yep. I'd have to agree, sadly. I think in the age of tea parties, we're unlikely to see $1 billion devoted to scanning the Library of Congress, as much as lots of people would like that. Okay, we'll have to move on. Tom, your prediction for 2010?
My prediction for 2010 is the continuance of something we've seen over the past couple of years, and I think it's going to continue to gather steam over the next year, and that's the convergence of the convergence that's driven by digital technologies of the library, archives, museums sectors, where the rise of digital technologies and actually, Dan, I think that one search box that Google provides means that the kinds of visitors that libraries, archives, museums get on the web are converging. The kinds of services they're expected to provide are converging, and the kinds of practices that they have to engage in on the web are converging. I think we're going to see more and more of that. I would add this acronym LAM that you see increasingly in the literature, library, archive, museum. I would add university as well, sort of the university scholar. So I'd maybe call it LAMU. I think that we've at the Center for History and New Media been collaborating with these cultural heritage institutions for a long time. Most of our projects would be impossible without strong collaborations with libraries, archives, and museums. And I think we're just going to see more and more of that in the next year, and probably in the next decade as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I was out at the AHA and I was talking to someone a little bit about this and sort of how much the LAMU world has learned from, let's say, Google. And I was sort of comparing it to the movement in architecture. There's a great exhibit, which I got to get to in New Haven, about the anniversary of learning from Las Vegas.
I read that book years ago.
Right. Very important book where a couple of Yale architects took their class to Las Vegas, which was never considered a great place to go for architecture. And I think their point was that, that there was something to Las Vegas, that in the popular world, we can learn a lot from the architecture, and that really led to a lot of important movements in architecture. These were very famous, what became very famous historians, Robert Venturi, of course, and Denise Scott Brown. But I think that they were onto something, that we can learn a lot from what's going on outside the academy, because I think there was a lot of feeling by Venturi and Scott Brown that, you know, academia can be a little bit closed and insular, and academic architecture become a little stodgy, and that there was something to, for instance, in Las Vegas, the notion of a building as a giant sign for what's inside. And I think in the same way, for instance, museums are realizing that their websites do have to be a lot of things, one of which is a giant advertisement for the museum. And you've seen the evolution of web design and these sorts of things in the same way that I think we saw an evolution in architecture as well.
I mean, I think this is driven by you know, user demands, where, you know, you have these students who grew up and users who grew up in a world of Google, and they go to Google and they search for, let's say they search for Thomas Jefferson, and they get a bunch of results. They don't care whether, you know, the notes on the state of Virginia, the copy that they find, it comes from the Library of Congress or the Smithsonian or the National Archives. I mean, they want to find what they find, and they don't care, right. You know, which letters are after your name. You know, whether you're a museum studies master's or you have an MLS or a PhD, they don't care who's put up the website. They don't care about your metadata best practices or anything. They just want to find what they find. And so, you know, there's this user-driven convergence of these areas, and I think that's just going to continue. And I think we see it in the little digital humanities community that we're part of, where, you know, we have just as many colleagues in the library, archives, museums fields as we do in history and lit and humanities. And so, you know, this is I think a big story for the next coming years.
Yep. Agreed.
Yep, I would agree, and it actually feeds into my next prediction. So maybe I'll just go.
Please do.
With that, and that is that. You know, I'm going to stick with our prediction from last year, which is more mobile. But I think, in particular, we're going to see more mobile in higher ed, both because of the incredible popularity of the iPhone, the things we talked about earlier about the growth of Android and open source in this. But I think that we're just going to see an awful lot more interesting applications for the use of mobile technology in higher education, and in particular for the reason that Tom just gave, and that is that increasingly our students see their phone as their access device for finding what they want. And it's no longer their computer that is that access device. It's increasingly their phone. And so if they want a document, they want to get it on, they want to at least look at part of it on their phone, if not the whole thing. They want to, and it's not just that they don't care where it comes from, they don't really care where they are when they get it. And so, for me, that's really exciting, because what I would really love to see is a student in the museum looking at a portrait of George Washington and thinking, you know, I remember that really interesting lecture about that almost revolt in Newburgh after the end of the war with the British, and that Washington gave that great speech. I wonder if that speech is out there. And then they take their phone out and they find the George Washington document app, and there's the Newburgh speech that he gives. And so, you know, I think that's just getting easier and easier. And I think what's going to really drive it is that our students are seeing the phone as their point of access to information.
Yeah, it's really, really, really true, right? And it's coming from the laptop and other sources that they really they've got their phone on their person at all times. And you know, Mills, you've really been visionary about the many situations, the field trips, the museum trips, the in-class uses that you can imagine them using. But it is the device that they've got on them at all times, and they're going to expect a lot out of that device, right? I think, you know, Google Goggles, the Android app that came out at the end of 2009, where you could, in fact, take a picture of something at the National Gallery of Art in downtown Washington, and it will pull up information about that. You could easily imagine you know, pulling up podcasts and lectures and things like that. So, Tom, further thoughts on that before we move on to predictions for the decade?
No, I agree. I mean, I think we're going to continue to see, and as I said earlier, you know, with the expansion and the adoption of these devices, I think we're going to see a lot more investment. You know, it's going to make sense for
cultural heritage institutions and higher ed institutions to put a little bit of money into building their own applications and mobile web content for these devices as they continue to as the price of handsets comes down and as the technology becomes more widely adopted. So I would agree with that as well.
Okay, actually, before we move on to our predictions for the entire decade, which we'll be horribly wrong about. We've had a lot of responses via Twitter. You can follow Digital Campus at Digital Campus, of course, on Twitter. And we posted a little question before we started the podcast about predictions from our audience. And I'm just going to go ahead and sample this. So predictions for 2010. Sterling Flaherty says that his ed tech prediction is that universities and colleges and humanities in particular will face greater scrutiny and calls for account with 2010 reform. I guess that sort of flows a little bit from this notion of openness, right? And but also, I guess we haven't talked much about the financial situation, which certainly will impact what goes on in the tech ed world in 2010. Meg Stewart writes in saying she's, you know, boy, we haven't mentioned this, but surely that the Apple tablet is going to mean that there will be an impact of the tablet PC for the first time in higher ed. And I have a feeling we're going to be talking about this in 2 weeks on Digital Campus 51. So we'll leave it at that. Let's see. We've got John Erickson writes in that his prediction is that the publication and consumption of data ramps up due to linked data and the semantic web. Well, we haven't really gotten deeply into the semantic web, but it is interesting that at the Library of Congress and other large repositories, they're starting to use this notion of linked data where you can very easily kind of pull out specific, query them via machines, but also human beings. A really good example of this is the New York Times has linked data. So if you see a story and it mentions, let's say, George Mason University, they have a topics page for George Mason University that finds all the articles for that and then links it to all the other things like professors at George Mason. And there's just a better sense of the kind of semantic entities within these articles and the ability to link them together. So this is interesting. I think what he's pointing out is that there'll be some new data mining techniques and ways of kind of navigating some of this great mass of digitized material and cultural heritage institutions like the Library of Congress and also in academic collections. Interesting prediction. Let's see. AJ Goulias says that Blackboard's course management software dominance will begin to crack as faculty and college IT pros embrace open source projects like Moodle. I guess following from Tom, your point about open source, interesting. Blackboard really has had a quite a stranglehold, and it'll be interesting to see if Moodle and Sakai can begin to crack it a little bit more this year. Let's see. Finally, Wally Grotefurst, oh, right here on George Mason campus, he's our associate librarian, writes that
I saw this one as well.
Yeah, during 2010, a library will post its MARC database to Internet Archive, and OCLC will claim infringement. This is kind of interesting. So these MARC records are basically the root of all these card catalogs. The MARC records are the particular records for books and other objects that are stored in libraries. And OCLC has often been the kind of holding place for these things. And there was a lot of controversy in 2009, only some of which we covered about the ownership of these particular records. And Internet Archive is, of course, building up openlibrary.org and an attempt to kind of get a response to Google Books that is comprehensive and that includes both scans and catalog entries. And kind of interesting point about what will happen to some of these large databases and whether they'll become more open. Finally, Mark Sample writes in with our comedy entry for a prediction for 2010. You guys will like this. He says, it will be the year Second Life makes it big. I think we went for all of 2000. Did we go for all of 2009 without mentioning Second Life?
Possibly.
You know, I was thinking that we may have gone the whole year without talking about it.
That's pretty incredible. But, you know, we need to add maybe a top three stories that didn't happen in 2009. And certainly Second Life would have to be in there. And I guess Google Wave would have to be in there, too.
But did you see that Mark followed up that prediction with another prediction that Foursquare adoption on campus solves all of the problems of higher ed, which you know, I guess Second Life didn't solve all of the problems of higher ed, but maybe Foursquare will.
Yeah, can we become mayor of the Johnson Center here on campus? okay, Foursquare, for those people who don't know, is a mobile application where I don't know, how do you even explain Foursquare? Can you explain Foursquare?
Not very well. I haven't really played with it.
It's a location-based social networking where it points out where you are and allows high quality stalking and things like that. Yeah. Okay. Let's move on quickly. Predictions for the coming decade from 2010 to 2020. And remember, we will be accountable for these things in 2020. Mills, let's start with you.
I predict that 10 years from now, the desktop computer will be over.
Interesting.
I think it's just, you know, I mean, who goes out and buys desktop computers now if they can avoid it? Why, already people would much prefer to buy a laptop, but I think it's going to be hard to find a desktop computer 10 years from now.
You know, that's kind of sad to hear. By the way, I agree. But, you know, I'm on the library expansion committee here on campus, and part of the new building is devoting a big chunk of a floor to desktop computers running Windows. Yeah. Well, we'll see if that happens. Tom, what's your thought? You agree? End of desktop computer?
Well, I don't know. I think we the desktop computer, maybe as we know it, won't exist. But I do think that something related to that, I guess, that I'd predict is something I would call ubiquitous computing, that I think we're going to have a computer, you know, we're going to have a desktop computer, we're going to have a countertop computer, we're going to have a fridge top computer, we're going to have a computer in our TV remote, we're going to have maybe this Apple tablet that we'd carry around, we're going to have the computer that is now the cell phone, or the cell phone, I guess, is now a computer. I think there's going to be... you know, I think the rise of new chip technology like the Intel Atom chip, and I guess they've got several new ones in the pipeline, the Ion chip and others, we're going to see more and higher, better and better computing power and smaller devices, and the rise of smart devices, I think, is going to be a story for the next decade. And so while we may still have a computer on our desk, it's just going to be one of many, you know, maybe Android-powered or iPhone OS powered or even Windows powered devices, possibly Linux powered devices that we use in all kinds of different ways.
Yeah, well, I guess that's a good segue to my prediction, which is rather similar but maybe slightly different. I think we're going to see the end of the web as we know it by 2020. That we've just spent the past two decades getting all of our museum and library and university websites, and certainly a lot of what we do here at the Center for History and New Media is building websites. And I think it's going to be difficult because of this end of the desktop computer and the end of, you know, well, let's design that for a 1024 by 768 screen, you know, that concern will go away, and we'll start thinking about really providing electronic resources that will operate on all these devices. So I guess is a flip side of Mills, your coin, that really there'll be such a software fragmentation that, you know, designing for different devices. And we'll really talk about services that run on things that have screens, that will be sort of laughable to talk about, you know, building just a website in 2020. That will be seem very archaic, and that the assumption will be made that whatever we're producing, whether we're in the business of digitizing collections or providing software or doing anything else in terms of electronic resources and tools, that we'll always just have to have in our mind that these things will happen in the dashboard of your car and in some pocket computer and some slate and some other thing, and then it's going to have to operate across a spectrum of devices. So I guess a tail end to what you said, Mills.
Well, I'm glad I'm not a web designer.
Right. It was so easy. I remember in 2001, we thought,
800
okay,
by 600.
800 by 600, or are we ready to move up to 1024 by 768? Right. Let's look at our server logs and see how people are accessing it.
Now we've got to move down to 2.5 inches. And
Right.
Right. So.
Right. Okay, Tom, you're batting cleanup here. Prediction for the coming decade.
My prediction for the decade is this will be the decade of DIY, do it yourself. Actually, it's probably related in many ways to your prediction, Dan, and your prediction, Mills, that I don't think that we're going to see universities, museums, archives, libraries doing as much outsourcing. I think we're going to see a movement towards insourcing. I don't think we're going to see these institutions hiring outside web design firms to, for instance, build them a website. I think a lot more of that work is going to be done in-house as sort of your ordinary employees are trained up to do this work themselves. And I think this is tied to the rise of open source software, where we are increasingly have new packages which we can deploy ourselves rather than hiring a firm to deploy for us. I think it's tied to the rise of linked data and to the kind of software fragmentation that you mentioned, Dan, where we're going to have to be, rather than just designing for one platform, we're going to have to be producing content resources that can be used on lots of different platforms. And I don't know whether that's something that you can really contract out. That's not something that I think you can say, we have 6 months and we're going to hire this company for 6 months to produce this thing, and that thing is going to then last us for 5 years. I think it's going to be a constant reworking, redeployment of the content resources that we have. And so I see this as a decade of insourcing. And I think, to the extent, obviously technology vendors aren't going to disappear, and nor should they. But I think what they're going to be doing in the next decade, rather than building stuff for us, I think they're going to be building stuff with us. And I think that's probably a more sustainable and in the long term, a better situation for our end users than the one I think we've seen over the past decade or two, where a lot of the technology work that we have all done has been outsourced to third parties.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is the inevitable sort of end of the story of the rise of really high quality content management systems like WordPress that actually are starting to add, for instance, mobile skins and things for other devices automatically. And I guess we have spent the last decade really learning the ropes, right? And learning how to do these things. And I think we've all gotten a lot better, and the people making free software, including, if we can toot our horn, the content management systems like Omeka, they just look really different than web apps that I remember from 2001, which were, on the code side, made out of bad spaghetti code that you couldn't maintain easily. And on the front end, just didn't look that great either. But now all that stuff really can be taken care of in-house if you select the right software and just have a little bit of technical knowledge. This has all become a lot easier. And I can't remember the last time I told someone to, go pick up a copy of Dreamweaver or something like that. But I think there's a new kind of DIY, isn't there, that you can see coming down the pike?
Well, yeah, and also, yeah. I think we've already seen what Tom was describing happen in the news media, where increasing amounts of content on websites of major news organizations is just being generated by the average public, average person in the public. And, just watching some of the news from Haiti from the disaster there on CNN, they're constantly asking, do you have, go online and tell us your story, upload your photos. And
right.
So, that would be unthinkable in network news 10 or 15 years ago.
Absolutely true. And the fact that we have these devices, right, is helping. I mean, particularly in the case of journalism. I was at a museum of the history of photography, and they had I had never seen it before, but the first cell phone with a camera in it, which was a Nokia phone from 2001. I mean, it's
wow.
Actually relatively recent. I was rather surprised. But all these devices and what you're able to do with aggregating it and sort of creating news resources, surely there'll be new modes of publishing and providing collections online that are similarly DIY and crowdsourced. Okay. Well, I think we've come to the end of an hour of our 50th hour here at Digital Campus. Tom Mills, great working with you on this. It's amazing we've been doing this for 3 years.
Kind of hard to imagine.
Even through stutter steps. And we'll be having some of our irregulars back on Digital Campus number 51. Also, a editor's note, we're going to start rotating the hosting, which we've always meant to do, but somehow I fell into the role
just
of...
You're so good at it, though.
I don't know about that.
And it's just so easy for us to sit back and listen to that.
So on the next podcast, yours truly, Dan Cohen, will have his feet up on his desk, drinking coffee and yapping off the top of my head. But we are going to start trying to rotate the hosting duties. So if you hear a new voice at the top of the podcast on the next round, you'll know what's happening, and looking forward to hearing from all of you again. We really encourage, and it was exciting to get some tweets today during the podcast. You can follow us at Digital Campus at Digital Campus on Twitter, and of course, we're always happy to get comments on digitalcampus.tv. Actually, there were some good comments from the last podcast about tweckling. Twitter heckling at conferences from some graduate students and faculty. So again, do follow us online. And Tom Mills, looking forward to talking to you again in 2 weeks on another episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Thank you.